RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
Dr. Aseem Malhotra is an NHS-trained consultant cardiologist specializing in heart disease prevention, diagnosis, and management. Aseem's been on this program already a couple of times in the time we've been going here at RCR. And he is in Miami, Florida at the moment. And we're here to talk about the movie he's made, premiered on the 24th of September in London, where Aseem tweeted, "A beautiful evening in London to start the redemption of medicine. Put public health and patients before profits of corporate psychopaths and save millions of lives." Aseem, welcome back to RCR. Nice to have you.
Great to see you again, Paul.
All right. First, do no harm, PHARM. Going to get into talking about that. I've watched the movie. Nice job. But I'm wondering, now you have really put yourself in the crosshairs of some serious, people with power who have been used to doing things in a certain way, making trillions, right? We're talking trillions of dollars. And now you've come along. There have been others, but you're very high profile. And from what I can see, what I've watched, you've just shot them out of the sky, Aseem.
Paul, to be honest, I see myself as a medium for a message and the sum of my influences. And the current system as we have it, is ultimately is self-destructive. The elephant in the room is that we will not be able to fix health or healthcare until we correct commercial distortions in the scientific evidence. And what does that mean? Well, for me, we will be winning when everybody knows, whether it's the taxi driver, the person working the coffee shop, the cleaner, the doctor, the CEO, everybody knows that right now, when it comes to medical research, most published research findings are unreliable or false. And the greater the financial interest in a given field, the less likely the research findings are to be true. That is the major issue right now in healthcare.
To the movie, I think you connected with Donald O'Neill, filmmaker. He's had some experience in this sort of zone before. In the early thinking about making this production, what was the aim? What was your aim to do?
Well, interestingly, the film came around. Me and Donal O'Neill have worked together before. We did a film in 2016, which was called The Big Fat Fix. Now, many people may not have heard of it, but it was, again, the aim of that movie was policy change. Interestingly, at that time, it was featured in BBC World News. The New York Times covered it. And we premiered it in the British Parliament. And it was really trying to help people understand the secrets of a healthy lifestyle. And it had a big impact in the UK on influencing the introduction of a sugary drinks tax. Tom Watson, who was the deputy leader of the Labour Party, after watching the film and reading a book related to it, he lost 100 pounds in weight, and then he went vocal and all that kind of stuff about it. So my aim with this as well, when Donal, we've been in touch for a long time over the years, and I went to give a talk in South Africa beginning of last year. And he saw my lecture and he said, "Aseem, your lecture itself is a movie." And he came up with this title. I think it was genius of him, First Do No Harm. And essentially the movie in many ways covers more than a decade of my life's work, trying to help people understand what the roots of the obesity crisis is, but simultaneously the linking of the chronic pandemic of chronic disease with an over-medicated population. So bringing that all together. And that's really what we did over sort of a year and a half, filming over five continents, in Europe, in the UK, across America, South Africa, Australia, and India, really to show this is a global problem.
I think someone in the movie makes the point that if you kind of own or control the box that people are trained in, then you kind of own everything. And I'm wondering about your experience, NHS-trained consultant cardiologist, as I mentioned. So your training would have been inside that box initially, I'm picking.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, to be honest, for me, as a qualified doctor since 2001, specialized in cardiology, subspecialized in interventional cardiology, in layman's terms, keyhole heart surgery, I realized that there are many great things we do in medicine, but there was a big gap. And I've been thinking about this recently, and what I would say is most doctors are well-intentioned. They just don't realize the information they're using more often than not when it comes to making clinical decisions for patients, especially with drug prescription as being corrupted by vested interests. So what are we really good at? What are doctors trained to do really well is make a diagnosis. Okay. We spend years in medical school learning about all sorts of diseases, understanding the symptoms associated with it, understanding what kind of tests help you confirm the diagnosis. And that's what we're very good at. We're not very good at understanding the root cause of a problem. In fact, we're trained to consider conditions like high blood pressure or type 2 diabetes. As some of those things that develop, it might be related to lifestyle, but there isn't much you can do about it once you develop it other than take pills. So there's not a root cause understanding. The second problem is we're also not trained, Paul, there's a big gap here, and it may sound strange, in basic management of many of these conditions through lifestyle. There is no nutrition training in medical school that relates to chronic disease, even though I, through my own practice, and I've been learning this over time and had to learn new things, have been implementing lifestyle changes for patients, especially with diet, and having patients reverse or send their type 2 diabetes into remission even within weeks, get them off their blood pressure pills, right? So that's the second issue. And the third issue, last but not least, Paul, which comes out in the film, is we're not actually trained to understand the medical evidence and then communicate that evidence in a way that is honest and ethical with patients, right? Basically, understanding, communicating health statistics. So we're actually not very good at engaging in true informed consent because we're not conditioned that way. So doctors, in many ways, are trained more to be biomedical technicians and not trained to be healers. And that's a big problem because right now we have massive problem of diseases like heart disease, type 2 diabetes, high blood pressure, anxiety and depression, you know, that is affecting probably now most adults to some degree. And we don't have the tools to deal with it as doctors. But of course, a lot of it is due to environmental factors, structural failures, you know, the food environment, psychosocial stress. In many ways, our culture of a materialistic society where we put value on image, fame, wealth, more than we do on human beings and relationships. So we have to go back to the basics of actually, what does it mean to be human? And that's really the solution to the problem.
Boy, who'd have thought? Vioxx. That is a huge example of really the whole architecture of pharma and food. Do we put those two together, pharma and food? Do they go together as big pharma and big food?
Well, I think that big pharma benefits from big food because, of course, big food is there to get us addicted to ultra-processed foods, if you like, because they want to sell food. That's all their own primary objective. And then we get chronic disease from that. And then that's an opportunity for big pharma to come in and obviously try and get people to take more pills. Vioxx, I mean, it's a great example of just how bad things can be and how things potentially still are when it comes to the medical industrial complex. So this was people don't know this, Vioxx was a so-called blockbuster drug that came out in the late 90s. Merck was the drug company behind it. It was thought to be a better painkiller or anti-inflammatory drug compared to, say, ibuprofen, because it didn't give the published research suggested that the gastrointestinal side effects were lower. Obviously, some of the side effects people know about when you take these drugs, it can give you stomach upset or acid reflux or even cause ulcers, or even bleeding in the stomach. They said, of course, this drug is just as good as ibuprofen as a painkiller, but doesn't give you those side effects. And it later emerged, Paul, that actually Merck had hidden data showing that the drug actually increased the risk of cardiovascular events, heart attack, stroke, death, by at least twofold. And it was eventually pulled from the market after about 5 years. Merck were fined almost $1 billion in 2011 by the American government. And it's estimated to have caused the deaths of about 60,000 Americans. Now, the issue with this, when you go deeper, and John Abramson, who's in the film, talks about this, and he's a Harvard lecturer, been involved in many litigation cases against the drug industry over the years. And he, in the internal documents revealed that he talks about, that the chief scientist of Merck, in an internal email, said, it's a shame about the cardiovascular effect of this drug, but the drug will do well and we will do well. In other words, they knew what it was going to do when it was being rolled out, but they thought, fine, you know, that we are almost public or acceptable collateral damage when it comes to us making profit. And then what makes it worse, when the FDA wrote to Merck, when they realized there was a problem with heart attacks and strokes with the drug, they asked Merck a few years later to put a black box warning label on the packaging. But what did Merck do? They completely ignored it and they doubled down on their marketing poll, right? So imagine this, once they knew that there was a big problem and it was affecting, you know, people in the population, they actually doubled down their marketing. They paid the New England Journal of Medicine hundreds of thousands of dollars for more reprints of the original article to use as marketing material. Now, you mentioned at the beginning about my tweet about psychopathic. I'm not saying that in an inflammatory way. I pride myself first and foremost as being an excellent diagnostician. I didn't come up with that diagnosis. That diagnosis came from Robert Hare, forensic psychologist, who was behind the original definition of psychopath, who said big corporations, as entities — I'm not talking about individuals here, let's be very careful with what we're saying, and this is what I genuinely believe — as entities, they actually fulfill the criteria of psychopathy. So, for example, callous unconcern for the safety of others, incapacity to experience guilt, repeated lying and conning others for profit. Now, what's interesting, if we bring this to the modern day, Paul, if you don't mind me saying this, when we had the whole issue with the COVID vaccine — and by the way, the movie doesn't touch on the vaccine issue for lots of reasons — but when the mandates were introduced, I was a bit surprised, because by that stage, when mandates were being introduced all around the world towards the latter half of 2021, this is after it became clear that the COVID vaccine wasn't stopping transmission, wasn't stopping infection, and came with serious harms. So I thought at the time, my intuition was, the only people that must be pushing or behind the so-called mandates have got to be the drug companies. And investigative journalists in America, Mr. Fang, I can't remember his first name, he actually exposed that in the summer of 2021, Pfizer funded and gave tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars to various grassroots, credible organizations in the US to push the mandate narrative. So what am I saying? When it's likely, Paul, that when these guys knew there was a problem with this COVID vaccine, that's when the narrative was pushed harder that it's safe and effective.
Like Vioxx.
And if that isn't if that isn't psychopathic, I don't know what is.
No, that's a good description of it. The medical journals, it's interesting too. I think the name off the top of my head escapes me, but the British Medical Journal editor that is in your documentary.
Dr. Fiona Godley. Yeah.
Fiona Godley, that's it. She, I think, said that those reprints that you talk about could earn a publication $1 million+. So now you can see the range of incentives. If that's just the beginning, that's a lot of money, a lot of coin. And the other thing too is, I was surprised to hear Robert Maxwell's name come up, as well as a kind of a pioneering the business model of monetizing medical, you know, pieces, journalism pieces, that sort of thing. And look what happened to him, and look, we know about his daughter. So, you know, so that kind of blew my mind. I knew that there was, you know, stuff going on, but the money, again, the money involved.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, Paul. When I was at medical school, even as a junior doctor doing postgraduate examinations, I never questioned what was published in a medical journal. I accepted it almost like a biblical gospel truth, like my colleagues did. Imagine. And most doctors are still in that place. And that's why this documentary is so important, because we need to unpick layer by layer how the information and why the information is being corrupted. And yes, medical journals are businesses. Fiona Godley says, as editors, you do your best to try and avoid that conflict. But she says it's very difficult when you're getting $1 million or £1 million from a drug company to your medical journal, and you're also using it for advertising, to remove that conflict. Of course, it's, you know, she's basically saying that we should have we should have a healthy skepticism what's published in medical journals. We have to try and remove the financial incentive when it comes to health information, you know, because it gets vulnerable to corruption.
The way that the efficacy of certain medications is transmitted, the narrative behind them, whatever description you want to use, is interesting. Because I think when it came to statins, which you, in fact, you came on my radar with statins, actually, and then everything else that's come along since, another great example. So if you actually were to say how effective statins were in terms of saving one person, and go through those numbers, no one would be interested, because there's so many people who have to take this medication for one person to benefit. It's never, ever put in those terms.
It isn't. And again, this isn't just my opinion, Paul. You know, I say I'm in some of my influences. Gerd Gigerenzer, who was the director of the Max Planck Institute in Berlin for health literacy, in a World Health Organization bulletin, interesting, 2009, said it was an ethical imperative that information is communicated in terms of absolute risk reduction between doctors and patients to protect patients from unnecessary anxiety and manipulation. In other words, the manipulation that comes from drug companies. So what does that mean? in very simple terms for your audience. You know, people think statins are these great, amazing drugs that reduce heart attacks and strokes and death. And they do have a small benefit. They absolutely do. But that information is not conveyed exactly to the patient how small that benefit is. And if you haven't had a heart attack, so by the way, most people prescribe statins around the world, and it's anything from 200 million to a billion people prescribe this drug, your benefit at best, and I say at best because this is still from data that has never been independently verified. This is another caveat in there. But if we accept it to being gospel truth from the drug companies, which clearly it won't be, then the best case scenario over a 5-year period of taking a statin, it gives you a 1% chance in preventing a non-fatal heart attack, a non-disabling stroke, without prolonging your life by one day. And it's really important that doctors convey that information to patients, because patients can get the illusion of protection from the drug. Sometimes they won't stop the drug because they think they might die because the drug's so important for them. And, you know, then when they've got side effects, that they, and then, of course, it distracts from lifestyle changes as well. So once you give people the full information, then we can actually move forward. And actually, data shows, studies show, Paul, as well. People say, well, hold on a minute. You know, if everybody stopped taking their statin, there'll be all these extra deaths and heart attacks and whatever else. Well, what's most important is people are empowered. But when they've done studies to show, did it have a negative impact on outcomes when you give patients information this way? No, it had the opposite effect. They were more empowered. It did not reduce outcomes in a negative way. And of course, saves a lot of money. Because think about the amount of cost, not just statins, but all the new, you know, these new drugs like Ozempic. We cover that as well in the documentary, the Alzheimer drug, you know, where it's just absolutely astounding when people realize just how fraudulent the system is. And that is the right description. You know, we have a medical system at the root which deliberately deceives in order to make money.
Is this a Western world problem fundamentally, or is this way of, well, fooling people being pushed everywhere now? Because there are some parts of the world that don't kind of buy into the Western medicine system. Am I right?
Yeah, it's a good question, Paul. I mean, I wouldn't comment so much about other parts of the world. In general, overall, I think it is it's the end result, if you like, of corporate capitalism or the excesses of corporate capitalism. You know, one of the ways of thinking about this is that it's actually an extension of colonialism. And colonialism exploited people for profit. It used to be across borders. It was based upon, you know, people from certain backgrounds or races saying we have better breeding, better science, better knowledge than you, and we're gonna implement our way of thinking and our culture on all these Eastern countries. Now the colonialism has moved from being across borders to within borders, and who's losing out? The poor and the middle class, and they're being exploited by a very small minority of rich elite people. Who, listen, I've got nothing against people making money doing the right thing, Paul. But the problem is, a lot of these companies, in fact, are making their money through fraud. They then don't pay their taxes. You know, they have ideological supporters with certain political groups. But actually, I think all of this is just rooted in ignorance, because it's a false economy and it's damaging people's health. And actually, the other problem as well, Paul, we have is it's actually self-defeating for the big pharma, for the pharmaceutical industry in many ways, because until this is unraveled, a lot of what they do is, you know, most new drugs are copies of old ones. So they change a few molecules here and there. They patent it, make it look like a new drug. It doesn't have any extra benefit of a previous drug. They make their money and then they move on to the next one when people have figured out it's no better than the generic. And that's obviously a huge waste, but they spend 20 times more on marketing than they do on basic science research. Once everything is made fully transparent, they can then actually genuinely, we can work on, you know, producing really innovative drugs that are going to benefit humankind. But to do that, the reality of this, Paul, is, you know, medicine should essentially just be there, which it's very good at, by the way. Let's not throw the baby out of the bathwater, with treating acutely ill people. Whether you're having a heart attack, whether you're in a road traffic accident, whether you've got a pneumonia, that's what we're good at. But less than 10% of our healthcare expenditure goes into acute care. Most of it is in chronic disease management. And of course, that's a big cash cow for the drug industry, who if they could, and by the way, this is a direction things are going, Paul. That's why we have to nip this in the bud. They would not just encourage or convince the public to get children or babies on statins. The next stage was manipulate the law, which they've done very well over the last couple of decades to get to this position of power, where they start mandating these drugs. Your child cannot go to school unless they're on a statin. Listen, it may sound crazy, But that's where they're headed. And we have to stop them, because this is a psychopathic machine that will not stop of its own volition.
No, I think you got a point there. Talking about, because in the end, this is a wealth transfer, isn't it? From low to middle income working taxpayers. Fundamentally, it's a wealth transfer. And I think also in the film, there's an example of the weight loss drug that you mentioned just before. I forget the name. I'm trying to remember all these drug names. Yeah.
Ozempic.
Yeah. And how that there was a trillion or almost $2 trillion market for that drug. I'm sure I heard it right.
You're right.
Yeah. Yet if you apply just the sensible things of lowering sugar to I think 12 teaspoons a day or below that threshold and making a few other changes, that you save the $2 trillion, you don't spend it, but you save another $3 trillion on the cost of that part of health. It's a no-brainer. Yeah. You'd think that politicians and policymakers and everybody would just instantaneously sign up to that, but they don't.
Yeah, I mean, Professor Robert Lustig, who is, I consider him the world expert on sugar, you know, he commentates specifically on that issue. And you're right. And of course, you know, it doesn't mean that these drugs don't have a benefit for anybody. But what happens is the drug industry will find maybe a tiny minority of people that might, where it's more good than harm. Say you're morbidly obese, you've tried everything, okay? And even though these drugs come with a lot of side effects, which again, we explain in the film, for that one individual where they literally are, you know, have tried everything to get to a position of better health, it might be useful for them. But for the drug industry, they want to expand the use of drugs to as many people as possible. So this is where we have to strike that balance, and it isn't happening at the moment. And of course, you know, you're absolutely right. There was a study a few years ago that showed that if the whole of the, currently we have about 20 million deaths from cardiovascular disease per year globally. But a study was done many years ago that suggested, and of course they all have their limitations, but just to give you an idea, that if the, if the world population, for example, just increased their consumption of nuts, you know, to maybe a couple of times more per week, and then we had more healthy fruit and vegetables and we quit the junk food, you'd half that death rate within a year. Dietary changes on effects on health are very, 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 sorry, very rapid. We can solve a lot of these problems if we had a magic wand by policy changes, and we could stop the healthcare crisis. We could improve population health within even just a year, theoretically, across the world, just by simple policy changes.
RFK Jr. breaking, well, he's already in the mainstream, I guess he's a well-known figure, but now with the election so close and getting him behind the Trump campaign and actually making speeches about people's fundamental health like they've never been made publicly before, does that give you hope? Does that mean that something is stirring, that, you know, the pushback is coming at a scale that could make a difference?
Absolutely, Paul. In fact, I've been in touch, you know, I would consider Robert Kennedy Jr. my friend for some time. And, you know, we've talked, we've interacted, we've given, you know, we spoke in an event together in California, you know, last year. And he absolutely understands what the problems are. He's a brilliant man. He comes from an amazing family. He's got very strong values. And that's really the key to the man, is that, you know, he said he wants to restore America as a moral authority in the world, which it was in the 60s before his uncle was assassinated. And he understands that the root of the problem is corporate capture of regulatory agencies, and he's willing to stand up and implement solutions to that, which are considered very radical, but necessary. You know, real sanctions, you know, CEOs of drug companies that are found to commit fraud should be going to jail. You know, what comes out, interestingly, in the whole issue with the Merck and the Vioxx scandal, is that one of their senior executives who was involved in it didn't go to jail, as Dr. John Abramson points out. He went over to teach at Harvard Business School, right? Absolute madness. Yeah. It's madness.
Yeah, and to see that the message that he had was well-received by the everyday, I won't call them fans, supporters. So there's obviously an awareness in populations now that something's not quite right. Do you think that's the case?
Yeah, I think so, for sure. I mean, if you look, you know, we didn't really want to get into the situation, and it's quite a horrific situation we're in around the COVID vaccine, but a survey in America recently revealed that 57% of Americans felt that the excess deaths that are happening in the United States are linked to the vaccine, right? So we've got this huge public awareness. The downside, Paul, but it is what it is, we just have to confront it head on, is that trust has massively declined in the medical profession. At the beginning of the pandemic, April 2020, it was 72% of the American public really trusted very highly or rated very highly the trust of doctors. It's now down to 40%.
Wow, that's that's a big fall. Yeah.
It's awful. It's awful. And what are the solutions? Listen, there is data and information. We are taught as doctors, if you make a mistake, then you have to apologize. The apology isn't enough alone. It's an important start. You then have to explain to the patient why the mistake was made. And you're going to say, I'm going to rectify this to make sure this never happens again. Mm. It's that simple, Paul. Until the medical establishment put their hands up in general, COVID vaccines or not, and say, listen, our current system is completely corrupted by big pharma, or to a very large degree. We are now collectively going to make sure that we do everything we can to ensure patients get full information on drugs and are given, you know, an opportunity to change their lifestyle and supported through that. Until that happens, this situation is only going to continue to get worse. And that's not a good place to be in. Our societies, cannot function unless we have a decent level of trust in our public institutions. Yeah. And that is, we're on road to something really quite horrific if this isn't rectified soon.
At the beginning of the film, you dedicated, I think, to your parents who have medical backgrounds. They're not here now, obviously. Did you know what they'd be thinking of you taking this on?
Yeah, I don't. It's difficult to know, Paul, for sure. I mean, I know that when I was doing all of this campaigning and activism and putting my head above the parapet and having threats to my career, they were both alive and they were both concerned, but always very supportive. You know, they were proud of what I was doing. My dad never told me to stop what I was doing. He just, you know, was concerned about my job security, obviously. But he always was very supportive of everything I was doing when it came to, you know, speaking out and calling out corruption. So, they both died, unfortunately, prematurely because of failures in the system. I never anticipated that because our healthcare systems were under so much pressure. My mum, you know, they missed a heart attack when she was in hospital. She also got admitted to hospital because she was somebody for many years, unfortunately, got addicted to all the processed food. And my father had an ambulance delay, for a cardiac arrest, even though the ambulance was called at the time he had the cardiac arrest and took 30 minutes to get there. And he probably would still be alive today if the system had been not under so much pressure because we hadn't dealt with a chronic disease pandemic. So, you know, it's a strange irony for me, but I'm going to keep fighting for my patients, for their memory, and continue my dad's legacy. He was a very prominent doctor, considered, you know, the lead campaigner to sustain or maintain values of the National Health Service, which essentially I also believe in, that, you know, healthcare should be a basic human right for everybody. It should be universal. But the most important thing about these healthcare systems is, and the NHS, Annie Bevan, who founded the NHS, the Labour MP in 1948, who was a brainchild behind it, said, it's not just about giving free healthcare for all, it's the best quality healthcare for all.
Right, yeah.
So that's what I'm aiming for, Paul, that every single person has the right and the opportunity to get the very best information when it comes to their health and the best treatment when it comes to their health. And we can do that if we change the system accordingly.
So distribution of First Do No Farm, I mean, you obviously want as many people to see it as possible. It can be viewed online. I think there's a small fee for that, but it's easy to view online.
Yeah.
But are you getting it into theatres, you know, theatrical release, or are people a little bit nervous about taking your movie? How's it been going?
Yeah, it's interesting. We actually ultimately screened it in the most famous cinema in the world, in the Odeon Leicester Square. Mm. We had 790 people roughly turn up for that, you know, it's invite only. And the Odeon, you know, they screened, they looked at it first and they thought it was fine. So I don't think any cinemas need to be concerned because the facts are very clear. They're not given in a very melodramatic way. You've got very clear experts in their fields talking about it. It's very difficult to refute. So I would say that about it. For me, it's, again, hitting the masses, but also hitting policymakers. We had a screening in the US premiere in the Senate, hosted by Senator Ron Johnson, who thought it was an excellent documentary. So for me, it's hitting policymakers and the masses. You know, we crowdfunded this. We wanted to remove any commercial influence. We put some of our own money into it. Of course, we want to at least break even. And then people can download it, you know, for a small fee at nofarmfilm.com. But we're going to keep going with this for, you know, for many weeks and months, and hopefully take it around the world, get it translated or subtitled into different languages, because it does affect everybody.
Is this a personal thing to go all the way for you? Will you leave nothing on, what's the old sports expression, nothing on the field? Or, you know, is this the cause for you to get done?
It is, Paul. Yeah. But, you know, it just comes back to my very, you know, my duty, our duty as doctors to patients is to improve their outcomes. And that means, you know, managing risks in the best way possible, treating illness and, you know, relieving suffering in the broadest sense, not just about people in being in pain, but actually a lot of the film also focuses on, without giving too many spoilers away, around the mental side, you know, the way we think, how we lead our lives and how that impacts on our mental health and physical health. So we have to do all of those things and think about the heart-mind connection. And if we do that, then I think we're onto a winner. But yeah, we have to fight for it, Paul, unfortunately. You know, there are a lot of people who, and I won't name them, I've got some very high-profile celebrity friends, patients who've seen the film. They love it. Really big names. But can you imagine, even these people themselves are too afraid to speak out because they're worried that they're going to get smeared by the media. Yeah. And their reputations may be tarnished. But you know, if we remain silent, there will be no solution.
Some things are worth fighting for, right? Some things are worth fighting for. You take a hit, you take some incomings, big deal, you know, if you're doing the right thing. I know it's easy to say.
And if we do it collectively, safety in numbers, Paul, you know that.
Yeah, yeah.
Then it's very difficult for these sort of large corporations to attack. You know, you can easily isolate one person. I've been a victim of that myself, but I've also had people behind me. And that's probably why I'm still here and why I'm still going. So safety in numbers.
Yeah, good point you made about mental health as well. I think I remember a scene from the movie with the Australian doctor saying he's got a couple in front of him. The first question is how's your relationship? Because if the relationship's good, then the health is going to be better. How often do you hear that from a doctor?
No, I know. You're absolutely right. In fact, all the research, psychology research shows that the single biggest determinant of sustained authentic happiness is actually the quality of our relationships, whether it was with our friends, in the community or with our partners. So we need to just go back to those. It isn't really rocket science, but we've created a culture where we are moving further and further away from what it actually means to be a human being, Paul, right? And that is clearly not going to be good for us.
Dr. Asim Malhotra, great to have you back. Really interesting to hear about First Do No Farm. Wish it all the success. And I'm sure we'll catch up again.
And I'll come over to New Zealand as well. I'm planning a New Zealand tour as well, Paul, probably end of November. So we'll get some screenings hopefully there.
Way to go. Might talk to you again then. Thank you, Asim. All the best.
Take care. Cheers. Bye-bye.
Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.